Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Take on a mission to unlock the real magic of that great Coca-Cola taste, updated with a twist. New limited edition flavor Coca-Cola Ultimate has been co-created with League of Legends. Taste the plus XP and level up by serving it ice cold for maximum refreshment. Scan the QR code on the bottle for unique digital and IRL experiences. League of Legends. Coca-Cola. Try new Ultimate Limited Edition flavor.
Who is your pick for the all-time greatest African midfielder?
He's the most naturally talented player that I've played with.
See if your choice made the list on Match of the Day Africa Top 10 from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson. At 1300 hours GMT, these are our main stories. A new UNICEF report says almost 300 children who tried to cross the Mediterranean by boat this year are believed to be dead or missing. Southern Europe, especially Italy, braces itself for record-breaking temperatures. The Indian Space Agency has launched its latest mission to land on the moon. Also in this podcast, the problem of trying to get tickets to music star Taylor Swift's world tour. And Guinness World Records has advice for people in Nigeria who want to get their names on the list for carrying out extraordinary feats.
Check out that it's legitimate. Who's the current record holder? You're not endangering your health and things like that. But Nigerians are quite proud and they seem to have got rather carried away.
A new report from the UN Children's Agency UNICEF highlights the human cost of failed attempts to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa to Europe. The UN agency estimates that nearly 300 children have died or disappeared on that perilous route this year alone. That equates to nearly 11 children every single week. Our Europe regional editor is Danny Aberhard.
The report focuses on the central Mediterranean route. That's the route from Tunisia and Libya up to Italy. It's often cited as the most dangerous marine route for refugees in the world. And it says that 11,600 children have made that crossing this year alone. And that is twice as many as the same period for last year. And that at least 289 children have disappeared or died during that time. They say that since 2018, 1,500 children have died on that route alone. They think that the number actually is probably much higher because many shipwrecks go unrecorded. And during this time, some two-thirds of the children that have that made that journey in the first 3 months of this year were actually unaccompanied. So there's all sorts of problems on this route.
It's a stark reminder, isn't it, of the risk many people are willing to take. We're talking about thousands, aren't we, of people attempting this?
Absolutely. And the UNICEF is very keen to underline that the risk of death is just one such risk that these people face. So children in particular, it says, face risks of violence, threats, separation from their families, detention. Girls are especially at risk of things like sexual violence, for example. And in the wider picture, the Central Mediterranean is just one route. There are other very perilous routes, such as the Atlantic route to the Canary Islands from places such as Morocco. And just today, there's been reports that 20 people have been washed up in a boat that was adrift for 18 days on that route. So at least 20 people died. They've been taken to the west, to a west town in Western Sahara. And there was also the terrible tragedy, obviously, off the coast of Greece last month, which saw hundreds of people feared drowned. And that was a route coming from Turkey. So there's right across the region that you see large numbers of deaths.
And does the report come up with any ideas of what should be done about it?
They are listing things that we hear time and time again. We see very little progress on these sort of things, though. So, for example, safe and legal pathways for seeking asylum, and also giving children better information about the risks. But the trouble is there are much wider issues such as conflict, the effects of climate change, and the sheer lack of economic opportunity in some of the countries these people are coming from.
Danny Eberhard. Well, back in 2015, Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor at the time, allowed more than 1 million asylum seekers into the country, making it the biggest host of refugees in Europe. It was a decision criticised by some Germans, and since then, many European countries have hardened their stance on migrants. Germany still remains the top destination for those seeking a safer or better life. And Jenny Hill has been to the Bavarian town of Landshut to speak to people there about how to respond to mass migration.
With its tall pastel houses decked in medieval bunting, Landshut looks every bit the traditional German town. But in one of the side streets, there's a Syrian supermarket, a reminder of how the 2015 migrant crisis changed this country. That's a source of pride for the mayor of Landshut, who we meet in the splendidly Gothic town hall. But Alexander Putz acknowledges the town faces new challenges as immigration rises again.
We do have difficulties housing refugees. People are coming again, and this puts a big strain on our housing market. We have 1,200 Ukrainian refugees here, but we have people from other regions too. It's a logistical problem, but it's not a social one. We have a harmonious community. But I don't want to diminish the issue. It can't go on like this forever. Most of the people coming to Europe, for whatever reasons, including economic ones, end up in two or three countries.
And Germany's governing politicians are in a bit of a bind. The anti-migrant far-right party, AfD, is surging in the opinion polls. If there were a national election tomorrow, they'd come second. That's partially, but not exclusively, to do with migration. Post-pandemic Germany is led by a squabbling coalition, which has yet to reassure an electorate worried by war, climate change, the high cost of living, and a crippling shortage of skilled workers. With his long grey hair, Alfred Kuttenlochner looks like he should be fronting a heavy metal band. But he runs a successful electrical company, one of the many Mittelständler, or family businesses, which underpin Germany's economic success. Trouble is, these days, he can't get the staff. The German government thinks migration could be the answer.
Migration is part of the solution, but not the solution itself, for the simple reason that these people just don't have the skills, not the language and not the vocational training. It's all right for big industry, the likes of BMW. You can learn in 14 days how to stand at an assembly line. But for the skilled trades like ours, it's much more complicated.
Alfred's employed two refugees, hopes that one day they might qualify as electricians. We meet one of them, Ahmed, who's from Syria, on a nearby industrial estate.
I've been working here for 7 years, 8 hours a day. So my boss, my colleagues are like my family now. My country is broken. It'll take years to repair. Germany is now my country.
Ahmed ending that report from Jenny Hill. And now to India.
Chandrayaan-3 has attained a major milestone successfully.
Chandrayaan-3 mission accomplished. Handing over to mission director.
And that's the sound from the Satish Dhawan Space Centre, where a rocket has been successfully launched as part of what's hoped to be the country's first successful moon landing. The Chandrayaan-3 mission means, if all goes according to plan, that touchdown will be achieved near the moon's south pole in late August. If that happens, India will join the United States, the Soviet Union and China in landing a spacecraft on the moon. Sridhara Panaka Somanath is the chairman of the Indian Space Research Organisation.
Congratulations, India. Chandrayaan-3 has started its journey towards Moon. Our dear LVM-3 has already put Chandrayaan-3 craft into the precise orbit around Earth. 170 by 36,500 kilometres was its intended target orbit, and it is precisely there now. And let us wish all the best for the Chandrayaan-3 craft to make its further orbit raising maneuvers and travel towards Moon in the coming days.
Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etharajan told me more.
This Chandrayaan-3 mission is very eagerly anticipated in India because India is making another attempt to put a rover on the South Pole in the southern part of the Moon. This is the first time as any country has attempted to put a rover in this place. Now, this will go on for 2 weeks when the rover will conduct various experiments on the Moon and send the details back to the Earth. Now, first, the spacecraft will go under elliptical orbit around the Earth before going into the Moon's orbit. And then it will attempt to send a lander and then this rover on the 23rd of August, where this particular rover will conduct various experiments. The first experiment did not succeed. Now, the Indian officials are hoping that this will go according to the plan.
So it didn't succeed. That was back in 2019, wasn't it?
They attempted the second mission of Chandrayaan in 2019. This spacecraft did manage to lift off successfully. It went around the Moon. It was still, this particular vehicle is orbiting the Moon, sending various data. When they attempted to send the lander and the rover, they just crashed on the surface of the Moon. And one of the scientists was saying that it was due to some glitch with the braking system. And now, for the last 4 years, the Indian scientists, space scientists, have been working to rectify and what lessons they had learned from the previous mission. And there is a lot of excitement about this mission because, as you said, India will become the fourth country in case if they succeed in sending this rover to Moon. And that is why the Indian government is also keenly watching how they can further go on with this space exploration methods, because India is also one of the countries which successfully sends satellites, for example, for communication and for weather forecasting. So this will be another landmark if this mission goes according to the plan.
Anbarasan Etharajan. In May, a Nigerian chef set a new world record for continuous cooking. Hilda Bassey prepared more than 100 different dishes over a period of 93 hours. And last month, Guinness World Records confirmed that she'd officially broken the record. But now the governing body is warning other Nigerians not to make so many record-breaking attempts. I heard more from our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
The feat of Hilda Bassey has inspired and provoked Nigerians to send in all sorts of records, and it's got a bit sort of over the top. And Guinness World Records, or GWR as they're called, are a bit overwhelmed, and they're basically telling Nigerians to calm down. So on Thursday, a Nigerian took to Twitter and said, "I'm coming up with an idea-a-thon, get ready." And GWR replied, "Please, enough with your record-a-thons." And a few days ago, GWR asked Nigerians to apply for confirmation before attempting to break a world record. So they say, look, check out that it's legitimate. Who's the current record holder? You're not endangering your health and things like that. But Nigerians are quite proud, and they seem to have got rather carried away.
Well, we've had this example of this Nigerian chef setting a new world record for continuous cooking. I mean, what other records have they been breaking?
So it's quite extraordinary. In 2021, a Nigerian DJ broke the record for the longest continuous DJ set in a place called The Grill in Lagos. Quite a grilling experience. It's 243 hours non-stop. There was the longest
243 hours?
Yeah, I know. They're worried about people's health. But then some more bizarre sporting ones. The most consecutive passes between two people using a head, heading a football, while balancing on the back of someone else. And their most headers of a football in a minute while lying down, which is 233. And a Nigerian masseuse collapsed after 50 hours attempting to do 72 hours of the longest massage on different individuals. And so we've had all sorts of things. American football touches with the feet in 1 minute. And then the West African other nations have also been keen to get on the act. And a Cameroonian comic said he would start the longest crying marathon by an individual. And a female Cameroonian said she would try to embark on a 200-hour sex marathon.
I think we can just leave it there, Richard. You can't follow that, can you?
Let's
leave it there. Richard Hamilton. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
runners chant before a statue of Saint Fermin. The bulls are released from their paddock and start chasing the runners.
Looking for inspiration at the famous Pamplona Bull Run.
Whether you call it football or soccer in your part of the world, Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the podcast bringing you the best of African football. I'm former Congolese captain Gabriel Zakwani, and joining me for hosting duties, Ivory Coast's Yaya Touré.
Hi, Yaya Touré, yeah.
And Nigeria's Efan Okoku.
Hi.
Each week, we're trying to decide who makes it to number one on our African football top 10 lists. That's Match of the Day Africa Top 10 from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The European Space Agency is warning that temperatures on the Italian islands of Sicily and Sardinia could reach 48 Celsius, which would be the highest temperature ever recorded in Europe. The heat wave is gripping Spain, France, Greece and Croatia, and there are red alerts in 10 cities, including Florence and Rome, which host tens of thousands of tourists during the summer months. Greece says it's shutting the Acropolis for a few hours today to protect visitors, as the country's meteorological service forecasts temperatures peaking at 41 Celsius in Athens. The BBC meteorologist Helen Willetts told me more about the effect of this extreme weather.
The relentlessness, I think, is having the biggest effect, Valerie. And we're going to get another wave of that heat as we go into next week as well. And it's been shifting its way from west to east this week. And we'll see a similar process, I think, into next week. So there's no respite. It's day and night. Daytime temperatures forecast to be into the 40s in eastern parts of Greece, Thessalonica today, for example. 44 degrees. And they're not dropping much below 30 overnight. You just can't get cool. And that's the biggest problem. And if you have a daytime temperature of 40 odd degrees, then it drops a certain amount overnight, but it starts from a higher base the next day. So it just keeps building, I think. And yes, I'm sure, as it is for me, the body really struggles to cool down in that sort of situation. And no wonder there are red warnings out for that.
Well, you mentioned red warnings, and a man has died in Italy this week. So there must be real concern about what's going to happen.
Clearly, there is a huge concern because we've got red warnings out across Greece, across Sardinia, Sicily, southern parts of Italy. They're moving into the Balkans, the warnings, red warnings tomorrow, because it's unprecedented. You know, these sort of temperatures are about 10 degrees above what you'd normally expect at this time of year. If you're going to southern Europe as a tourist, you expect it to be warm at this time of year, but this is quite exceptional. You know, we saw reports earlier in the week about heat being a silent killer because of the extra 60,000 deaths that we saw from the heat wave last summer. As I say, you know, you expect it to be warm, but this is exceptional.
Southern Europe suffering, but it's not just about Europe, is it? This is going to happen in other parts of the world too.
Absolutely is, Valerie. I mean, this is all coming out of the north of Africa, where the temperatures have been pushing towards 50 degrees at times over the last fortnight. So that's through Algeria, Morocco, Mauritania, those places, for example, having the sustained heat right the way across into Tunisia. But also, as we go into the weekend, even now, the heat is building across California, Arizona. There's been talk about potential record-breaking heat through Death Valley this weekend. I've heard temperatures mooted at about 120 Fahrenheit, so really exceptional heat across other parts of the world as well.
So we've talked a lot about what's happening on land and to people. What about the oceans?
Well,
and the seas.
As the land's warming, as we know with global warming, temperatures generally are higher. And that means that water temperatures are higher as well, because the air meets the ocean and they mix. So I imagine, I haven't looked at it in detail, but I imagine the Mediterranean waters are warmer. We had warmer waters around our shores back in June when we were having, that's here in the UK, having that exceptional heat when we had our hottest June in decades. So I imagine that is having a big impact as well.
Helen Willetts. It's the final day of the eight-day-long Running of the Bulls Festival in Spain. The San Fermín's festival takes place in the city of Pamplona, where participants are chased through the streets by bulls. As the festival concludes, it's also trying to make women feel safer, as Guy Hedgeco reports.
Believe it or not, it's 6:45 in the morning in central Pamplona, and this band is performing one of many traditions linked to the San Fermín's festival, known as Las Dianas. The idea is to wake up the city for the day's festivities. And so these musicians are marching through the streets, playing extremely loudly. Although the San Fermín's festival is best known for the running of the bulls, in recent years it has also been associated with a much more disturbing practice,
sexual assault. In 2016, a young woman was gang raped inside a doorway in the building that I'm standing in front of during the festival. The case became famous nationwide and drew attention to the problem of women being groped and assaulted during the festival. Heavy drinking and all-night revelry are commonplace during the festivities, and the local authorities are trying to clamp down on sexual assaults on women, whether it's rape or gropings. At this information point in central Pamplona, volunteers explain to passers-by how to contact the relevant authorities and make a complaint. Edurne Monreal is a local woman.
It's not only like touch, you have a verbal abuse as well. And you can see everywhere people that talk to you like there's no rules. And it's San Fermín, but there's rules, no?
But she adds that the local authorities' efforts are paying off.
A little by little, we are improving.
Just round the corner, locals and tourists are gathering for the morning's running of the bulls. Last night it rained very heavily, so the conditions underfoot are very slippery. There's a big crowd gathering now behind wooden barriers that line the street. So the spectators stand behind those, and also the balconies along these streets are packed full of spectators who are almost all of them wearing the traditional white garb with a red neckerchief of San Fermines.
Well, my name is Nicolas Garcia. It is really special to be able to run from the bulls. The excitement that you get, the rush of adrenaline that you get from the bull is pretty crazy. And it's a thing that you got to do once in your life, right?
And what does your mother say about that?
Well, she was really nervous about it the first time. But everyone has done it that has lived in Pamplona.
The runners chant before a statue of Saint Fermín, asking for his blessing. Then a rocket is fired into the sky, and the bulls are released from their paddock and start chasing the runners. The runners are coming very fast. Running like crazy. Here come the bulls. Here come the bulls. The last death during the running of the bulls was in 2009, and luckily nobody has been badly hurt this time. This deeply traditional event is grappling with the challenges of the 21st century. But for now, at least, San Fermines is still going strong.
Guy Hedgeco in Spain. Here in England, the Prince of Wales has expressed his support for the footballer Dele Alli, who's spoken about his mental health struggles. In an emotional interview, the 28-year-old Everton midfielder revealed he was molested at the age of just 6 years old, made to sell drugs by the time he was eight, before being given a new home through adoption. He spoke about being sent to Nigeria to instill discipline in him, and Alli said this trauma had led to a sleeping pill addiction as a player. Dele Alli has just left a clinic dealing with addiction, mental health and trauma, and says he hopes speaking out will give comfort to others in football who are facing similar issues. Here's what he said to Gary Neville, the football pundit and former player, on the Overlap channel about what led to his decision to ask for help.
To be honest, I was caught in a bad cycle. I was relying on things that were doing me harm. I was waking up every day and I was winning the fight. Going into training, smiling, showing that I was happy. But inside, I was definitely, losing the battle. And it was time for me to change it, because when I got injured and they told me I needed surgery, I could feel the feelings I had when the cycle begins. And I didn't want it to happen anymore, so.
Dele Alli. Gary Bloom is the first psychotherapist to work in-house for a football club here in the UK. So, how common are mental health problems in the sport?
It's a lot more common than people realise, to be honest. And it's largely unreported. Football clubs really are only just waking up now in the last couple of years to the realisation that when people have off-the-field issues, they inevitably end up on the field. And that's why, in my opinion, more clubs should be employing psychotherapists who are able to mix and mingle freely with players and warn those players of the consequences if they don't clean up their personal problems, because they're going to affect their performance. Remember, there are thousands and thousands of people who are armchair football coaches and managers and who are passing an opinion on somebody's performance. But that's one pressure. The other pressures are the kind of things you'd expect, like what happens if your recovery from injury isn't doing well, what happens if your performance slips, you're just off form. And then the off-the-field stuff like relationships, bereavement, addiction to sleeping tablets. And that's widespread in the game, much, much wider than people realise. And the reason that's happening is because there's also a widespread use of caffeine stimulants during football matches. So players who are pretty wired during the games because they want to give themselves a buzz, a legal buzz, during the games, then can't get to sleep at night. And they're being prescribed sleeping tablets, and that cycle goes on.
Psychotherapist Gary Bloom. In the US, at least 16,000 actors and writers are on strike, demanding better pay and increased safeguarding as artificial intelligence threatens their jobs. As an experiment to see how AI could affect all the creative industries, the British prize-winning author Bernardine Evaristo has been testing out ChatGPT. And she told Martha Carney about her experience.
Someone introduced me to it and set a task, which was to imagine a sequel to Girl, Woman, Other set in a building where we were, an island. And it came up with this great idea. And I was like, oh, my God, this is what people have been talking about. And I realised when talking to other people about it, other writers, that a lot of us haven't really engaged with it. But actually, it poses an existential threat to our profession as writers, because its aim is to outperform human activity that has economic value. I mean, that is one of its goals. So that's...
And you tried it with Virginia Woolf as well, didn't you?
I did. And it came out with a sequel to Virginia Woolf. It will write in the style of particular writers. But the thing is, there are copyright issues there, because we haven't given our material to be used as a training model for this piece of software. It's just taking it.
That's interesting, because there's a court case going on in America with a comedian, Sarah Silverman. She's suing ChatGPT for exactly that, for using her material.
Well, she is, but also there's a class action lawsuit, because apparently this software has drawn on something like 300,000 published novels to be able to do what it's doing. And so there are copyright rules. I mean, Sam Altman is the CEO of OpenAI, and OpenAI created ChatGPT. And he himself is saying, we need to have legislation to govern this, because it's running amok. It's a really dangerous tool. Of course, it's also really exciting.
Is it really dangerous enough for creative writers like yourself?
Oh God, yes. Because it's doing what we do, based on what we have already done in the past. At the moment, I would say, with my experiments, the writing hasn't been great. It can come up with a novel in seconds. And of course, this is very tantalising for people who want to write but don't actually really want to write. But for those of us who do write, it can replicate the work of proofreaders, illustrators, editors. The whole industry could actually be transformed in such a way that people lose their jobs and that the industry is relying on AI.
And do you think it is going to be possible to bring in laws to govern this?
Well, I don't know, because that's kind of outside of my realm. But I feel that we need to look at it really seriously. And just because it exists, just because it can do this, doesn't mean to say it's good for our society. You know, technological advancements have to be beneficial to our society. There is nothing wrong with our imaginations at the moment. There's nothing wrong with our creative writing. So why would you replace it?
The writer, Bernardine Evaristo. The American music star Taylor Swift is on a world tour that's on course to make $1 billion in ticket sales. There's a scramble for places at her shows among her fans, and many parents of her young admirers, who are known as Swifties, have also got in on the act. Journalist Krishnan Gurumurthy told us about his experience trying to book tickets for the Eras Tour, which is coming to the UK next year.
When I was young, you just used to go to the record shop and try and buy the tickets. These days, you have to get a pre-sale code, or in this case, a pre-pre-sale code, which we had to pre-order the album Midnights in order to get a pre-sale code. This was back in October last year. We then had months of, oh, Dad, the dates haven't been announced, and do you think she'll ever come? And maybe, you know, could we go to America and watch her? No, we couldn't. Why not? Because it's quite expensive to go to America. And then we finally, the day comes, and it turns out that it is Jasmine, my daughter's 18th birthday, when the first tickets are going to go on sale, which makes it incredibly stressful because this could ruin her birthday. And I actually took the morning off work, not so that I could spend it with Jasmine on her birthday, but so that I could try and get her Taylor Swift tickets. And I spent a very, very difficult, you know, hour and a half at least online, queuing on the Ticketmaster website, trying to get tickets. And you start at something like 26,000th in the queue when you finally get in. You count down and you have to sort of sit there staring because you don't know when your moment's going to come up. So you sit there in front of the computer trying to get the tickets. And then I got to zero and the thing crashed and kicked me out and said, you've been logged out because of an error. You will be re-logged in. And we got back in and then we had another 20,000 people in front of us. So we just kind of gave up in sort of despondent depression and decided to go for a birthday lunch. While we were at the birthday lunch, we then decided, well, let's have another go because there's going to be a new sale starting at 1 o'clock for tickets in Edinburgh, which, of course, is quite expensive to get to from London, but, you know, it might be our only chance. We tried again. Amazingly, this time we did get in because we were only about 7,500th in the queue, and we managed to get the tickets. But, I mean, my goodness me, the blood pressure and the stress. It was just about worth it because we got tears of joy at the end from my daughter. But I mean, you know, my goodness me, I don't know what's happened to the world.
And how much are you spending in dollars, please? Are you spending an absolute fortune?
Well, actually, no. I mean, Taylor Swift has been quite careful to make sure that there are affordable tickets. So I think the cheapest tickets are about $70 or so. And the most expensive, this is for sort of normal admission, are around just over $200. And so we got ours for about $125 each.
And are you going?
Well, no.
After all this?
I mean, I wish I was, in a way, because I do actually really admire Taylor Swift. I think she's brilliant. But no, I think I will let my daughter take a friend, which I think is much more appropriate than old man jigging around, surrounded by young fans.
Aging Swifty and devoted dad, Krishnan Gurumurthy. And that's it from us for now. But before we go, here's Jackie with news of what's coming up in this week's Happy Pod.
Thank you. Yes, this week we will hear from the man behind a portable lightweight incubator saving babies' lives in Ukraine, the origins of the romantic kiss and how it seems to be an older phenomenon than once we thought. The community alarm system in Uganda, inspired by African drums and facilitated by modern tech, a novel way to help the Great Barrier Reef rebuild, and how a soup ladle, a suitcase and a fan were used to save a woman under attack in Taiwan. The Happy Pod, available on Saturday the 15th. Of July.
Thanks, Jackie. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fox Porter. The producer was Nisha Patel. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye bye.